loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, President Trump signed the enormous National Defense Authorization Act today. What's in this bill? Then, society is facing a watershed moment as more and more women offer revelations of sexual harassment and sexual assault committed against them. A new documentary film has just been released featuring 16 women, each of whom says that they were the victims of abuse and harassment by Donald Trump. In this segment, we talk about the role of the Democratic and Republican parties as they both try to take advantage of this moment and this movement for their own narrow political agendas. But first, we turn to the NDAA. President Trump signed the National Defense Authorization Act today, saying that, quote, the military has got to be perfecto, close quote. Yes, that's the president. The new NDAA provides a largely secret budget of $700 billion to the Pentagon. But what else is in the budget? For example, can the Pentagon still arrest and detain American citizens without benefit of trial? We are joined from New Mexico by Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. And from Tulsa, Oklahoma, by Dr. Jeremy Kuzmaroff, a professor at the University of Tulsa and author of the book Modernizing Repression, Police Training, and Nation Building in the American Century. Jim Cavanaugh, let's start with you. What's the most important takeaway from this new bill? I mean, of course, the Congress adopts it every year. The Congress is required to adopt it. It's the budget for military spending and other spending. But what's your big takeaway?
Well, you know, since I don't know all the details of it, I've seen reports during the year. But I think the big takeaway is that, again, we have an increase that's beyond even what Trump asked for. The Congress, including the Democrats, pushed for more money than he asked for. We have spending for the military that's kind of unlimited. It demonstrates that Trump, despite what anybody thought, despite whatever he said, is part of the military-industrial complex. He was saying, I'm going to cut back on the wars, but I want to increase military spending. This is going to create more and more tension, and everybody's behind it. It demonstrates the tenacity of the military-industrial complex in the United States. These bills are structured in a way that give contracts throughout the country in almost every congressional district, hundreds of bases, thousands of contracts every day, and it becomes very difficult for any congressperson to vote against it because they're voting against pork that's coming into their districts. Essentially, the military bill, this is military Keynesianism, you know, is ersatz socialism. This is the way they end up spending money because it does create jobs in districts, et cetera. That's why people like Rand Paul vote against it. This is the backbone of both American foreign policy and a certain sense of American economic policy is these crazy, insane military budgets. It also demonstrates that, you know, this budget, the increase in this budget would have paid for programs like Free College for All. This is $700 billion, plus more money. That's just military budget. There are other things like $100 billion for the debt. The Pentagon share of the interest on the debt. There's a guy, William Hartung, who's done a very good analysis, shows it's about a $1 trillion budget at the end of the day when you add in all the hidden things.
Yeah, let's go to Greg Mello. Is that right, a $1 trillion budget when you think about deficit spending for previous military budgets, previous wars? And also, Greg, you're in Los Alamos Study Group. You're watching the Pentagon. You're watching especially the nuclear wing of the Pentagon budget. What's your big takeaway from this NDAA?
Yes, I think the previous speaker was quite correct. It's at least $1 trillion because it includes the nuclear weapons programs of the Department of Energy as well as the DOD, plus the interest. That's very important. Plus, you know, if you really consider Homeland Security, a lot of that, plus the military programs of the State Department, used to be about half of NASA was military related. So you add it all up, it's really a huge amount of money. It's more than $1 trillion. And it's really a majority of the discretionary spending of the United States government, which raises the question of whether they're, you know, is it military-industrial complex influencing the government, or is it really the bulk of the government itself? We are quite concerned about a provision in the bill that was put there by our Democratic senators from New Mexico to fast-track and commit the federal government to build a replacement for the Rocky Flats plant to produce nuclear weapon cores here in New Mexico. It's a lot of money, and we don't have a factory to produce these cores. We have 16,000 sitting over in Texas in bunkers, but the idea is that if there were new kinds of warheads, a specific warhead which is the part of the program of record, that would be developed and go into production about in the late 2020s, early 2030s, that we would need new cores for those warheads, and this would provide work for the nuclear warhead complex across the country, including here in New Mexico, while also fielding a new warhead in sufficient numbers to break out of the New START treaty, should that be desired, even though it expires, 2021? This would be for re-MIRVing land-based deterrent, assuming that it's completely replaced, as is part of this budget too. So we're quite concerned about that. The other thing that in the nuclear weapons part of the budget that really jumps out is the requirement to develop a missile system which violates the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty, the INF treaty.
Before you continue, let me just ask you, is that a deliberate effort? Because there's been talk about the fact that the U.S. government, the Pentagon, actually wants to get out of the treaty. Is that a conscious act?
Well, I think some people want to get out of it, and others want to create a bargaining chip because U.S. intelligence claims that Russia has violated the treaty. It's part of, gamesmanship between U.S. and Russia, and part of this deterioration that's gone on. So, yeah, I think there's different groups with different objectives.
You know, I think there are a lot of other things, too, to be worried about related to the new NDAA from a governance perspective. First of all, the two versions, the House version and the Senate version, were passed by voice vote, right? All those in favor say aye, all those opposed nay, the ayes have it. So really, we don't have any idea who voted for this or who didn't, other than people like Rand Paul, who then took to the floor of the Senate and said that had this been a recorded vote, I would have voted against it. Another thing, too, is it's unclear what this does. First of all, with sequestration, it certainly busts the budget to the point where it may be actually illegal to appropriate this kind of money to the Pentagon. And also, we don't know how this is going to be viewed under the 2011 Budget Control Act, which was supposed to reduce the budget deficit. This clearly defies the spending caps that were set in 2011. But who's going to have the guts to stand up and say, we need to take this to the courts? I think that remains to be seen.
Go ahead, Jeremy.
Oh, well, I think, yeah, we've seen, kind of fecklessness for many, many years. And the point was made earlier that the system is almost designed, to avert dissent because of the way the money is distributed. A lot of the money is going for military bases, some outside the country, but a lot of them are in the country. And it brings the pork home. In Oklahoma, where I'm based, the military is king. It's one of the major, the major employer in the state, and nobody will stand up against it. So, there's a fecklessness that we see in Congress that's kind of sad.
Yeah, Jim Kavanaugh, the NDAA apparently contains other provisions relating to Russia as well, including an extension of existing limitations on security cooperation with Russian forces. That would be Section 1231. And it provides authorities for providing security assistance to Ukraine, Section 1234. I mean, let's look at Section 1232 would bar the executive branch from using any Department of Defense funds to, quote, implement any activity that recognizes the sovereignty of the Russian Federation over Crimea. I mean, this is politics and sort of meaningless agitation, like American agitprop from the Pentagon inside the NDAA. Talk about some of these provisions, and particularly about Ukraine and Russia, if you would.
Yes, well, that was a big deal during the campaign when Trump was challenged about not having provisions for weapons for Russia in the Republican platform. The Democrats went after him for that. Of course, this is coming back in now. There's going to be weapons to Ukraine. They're going to increase the presence of NATO on the Russian border. This is very provocative, and these are policy decisions that are essentially hidden inside the budget. They're not just budgetary decisions. They're policy decisions. You're going to prevent anybody from recognizing sovereignty over them. I mean, that's an important policy decision, and there should be discussion about it, but it's not a budgetary decision. So these are all policy decisions that are designed, again, to provoke some kind of conflict with Russia and to constrain the president and the executive branch from acting independently of the drive for conflict with Russia. It's very dangerous. It's very dangerous. And we were talking before about the possibility of trying again to go after RT and keep them off of American cable packages, or, you know, tell people that American cable providers can't be forced to carry those channels. So it's, again, it's all kinds of policy in this that are designed, one, to foment dangerous provocations and possible war with Russia, arming a regime in Ukraine, which is a fascist regime, and, you know, creating policies about restricting access to information in the country that really aren't budgetary policies. These are not fiscal policies. These are political policies that are being hidden in a budgetary package.
Yeah, and John, one way to get an amendment passed, even about policy, not about budget, is just attach it to the NDAA.
Yes.
Since, as the other guests have said, the NDAA sails through Congress because they're all doing their patriotic duty to fork over the national treasury to the arms contractor. So you put in an amendment and probably will sail because it's part of the overall bill. And what Jim Kavanaugh is talking about is something called Amendment 1096, which aims to, quote, prohibit multi-channel video programming distributors from being required to carry certain video content that is owned or controlled by the government of the Russian Federation. That's part of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Which has absolutely nothing to do with the National Defense.
It's an attempt to stop broadcasters or cable companies from carrying RT. So Americans who want to have alternative media will now be barred, perhaps, if this succeeds, from watching a TV network. I mean, what does that have to do, Greg Mello, with national security?
Well, you know, we're engaged in this informational war, it seems. And it's really, if people only knew, you know, it's not the United States we thought we had in the past.
You know, I think of that Morgan Freeman video, "We're at War."
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a big theme of Hillary Clinton, is that the United States is losing the information war. And at the same time, I think Ray McGovern got up and turned his back on her at George Washington University. She was talking about freedom of the press and how we have to use the press and we're losing the information war. So he stood up in protest and police came and beat him up and dragged him out of the
car. Dislocated his shoulder. Right. Yeah. 75-year-old man.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Brian, let me get back, if I may, to this issue of legality. Reuters is reporting that the NDAA that was signed today authorizes $634 billion in base defense spending. But the Budget Control Act of 2011 that I mentioned a few minutes ago only permits $549 billion that's allowed under sequestration. It is illegal, then, to budget $634 billion for base defense spending. On top of that, it includes $66 billion for what they're calling special war funding. Now, never mind the fact that we're not legally at war with anybody and haven't been since December the 8th, 1941. But what is this $66 billion supposed to be used to wage war against? This is an issue that Congress has never discussed. There were no open hearings on this. We have no idea what this money is for.
I think they call it the Overseas Contingency Operation Fund, which is really the war waging fund. And it's not part of the base budget, as you say. It's kind of this weird thing that, you know, we don't count that as part of the Pentagon budget, but that's what we're going to use to wage war with. That's going to go to Afghanistan and Somalia and Syria, where there are at least 2,000 and probably twice or three times as many American troops.
The military spending, Greg Mello, I want to talk about this NDAA. You're estimating, as was Jim Kavanaugh, that while the budget is $700 billion, and that's, again, more than what Donald Trump asked for.
That's right.
I think by $30 or $40 billion, the real number is it really about $1 trillion. $1 trillion, that's 1,000 billions. And $1 billion is 1,000 millions. I mean, people don't even know what these numbers mean. I mean, there's such an extraordinary level of spending. But Greg Mello, how does it stack up against the other countries, the major countries in the world in terms of military spending, and why?
Oh, goodness. I think that if you add up the next in line, you could come to about 9 countries before they add up to as much as we are spending. We spend, I think, roughly about 10 times what Russia spends on its military. It's, you know, when you think about it, spending at this level precludes many of the things that modern society would demand of a first world country. It precludes a good education system. It precludes substantial investments in renewing our infrastructure. It precludes a proper response to the existential climate emergency. People think we can have everything here because it's been a luxurious place to live, but we can't.
Yeah, if you look at I'm just looking now, John, at the military budget. The United States is going to spend $700 billion. Last year, China spent $171 billion. Russia spent about $84 billion, somewhere between $60 and $84. And guess who's the fourth largest military spender? Anybody want to guess? Ding, ding, ding. Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, greater than France. And of course, the United States gives all of, I mean, Saudi Arabia is buying American weapons. In other words, Saudi petrodollars are subsidizing these same contractors. So in a way, you have to add the Saudi military budget, which is $62 billion for Saudi Arabia, to the American military budget of what is really nearly $1 trillion. That's the real number.
I'll go you one farther. Add the Israelis, the Bahrainis, the Kuwaitis, the Emiratis, the Omanis.
That's all American military money to American companies.
That's right. All of it. Billions of dollars.
Okay, so let's come up with a new equation. The real military budget, when you include Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Israel, the other Gulf monarchies, the United States, maybe like 1.3 or 1.4 trillion. The United States, Jeremy, seems to me to be based on spending, and spending says what your priorities are. It seems to be addicted to war. It seems to be addicted to militarism. And as Jim Kavanaugh said in the beginning, it's not just part of a military equation. It's got to be at a certain point when you spend this much money in any particular area, a big part of economic calculations.
Absolutely. But, you know, I think what's not debated is that it's actually very harmful. You know, we've invested, the late Seymour Melman was an economist at Columbia University, and he wrote some, I think, very important essays starting the Vietnam era, pointing to the fact that, you know, military spending is very parasitic. It diverts money from civilian manufacturing and, you know, from producing innovations in these areas, and that, you know, civilian manufacturing produces a lot of offshoots and a lot of jobs, whereas military spending and industry tends to be very parasitic and doesn't have broader benefits for the economy and could also be temporary. So people don't discuss that. You know, when we discuss the decline of U.S. manufacturing and some of the structural deficits, there's no politician who's raising, even Bernie Sanders, how detrimental it is to U.S. economic competitiveness and the, you know, connection with the decline of U.S. manufacturing. So I think it's very harmful in many ways, including, of course, the diverting of spending from social programs are evolving and more into our society has more of the values of the military authoritarian characteristics, violence has really seeped into the fabric of our society more and more. So it's in so many areas, it's impinged on the quality of life in the United States. But unfortunately, no major political figures, even Sanders. I mean, Sanders, I think, shares the critique most of us on this program have, but he's a bit shy in raising these issues consistently.
Yeah, shy may be a generous way to...
That was nice of you, yes.
That was nice.
He gets the money in Vermont for the F-35,
Well, the F-35, just to talk about the F-35, a plane that Donald Trump railed against, but then he said it's better now because Donald Trump, fixed it.
Just a comment here that Bernie Sanders has received more campaign cash from military sources than any other senator.
Wow. Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
Wow. That's Greg Mello. That's Greg Mello from the Los Alamos Study Group. Say it again.
Yes. If you go to opensecrets.org, you'll see the Bernie Sanders has received more campaign cash than any other U.S. senator from the military.
No wonder he's shy. Let's raise another issue in this NDAA, the detention facility at Guantanamo. I mean, President Obama came in 2009. He controlled the U.S., controlled the White House, certainly. He was a popular president. He controlled the House of Representatives, controlled the U.S. Senate, big margins. He said he was going to close Guantanamo. Now we are 1 year into Donald Trump, 9 years after Obama took office. Not only is Guantanamo prison facility still open, this new NDAA says, as proposed, it would impose various restrictions on matters relating to the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. Most notably, Section 1033 would continue to prohibit the executive branch from using any Department of Defense funds to transfer detainees held at Guantanamo to the United States. So in other words, the NDAA, again, spending all of our money supposedly for national security, goes out of its way to tell the president, something he would never do anyway, to use any defense spending to transfer inmates. That means Guantanamo, which the UN, John, has identified as a torture center. That's the UN
That's
characterization
right.
of it.
Yes.
Remains open 9 years after Obama came in.
Yeah, and there are a couple of reasons for that proviso, Brian, none of which we should be proud of. One is that our elected officials in Congress are too cowardly to stand up and demand that constitutional rights apply to everyone. And they'll say things like, there was a congressman from Illinois just in the last couple of months saying that it's just too dangerous to bring these awful, awful terrorists onto U.S. soil, as if we don't have maximum security prisons that contain dangerous criminals in them as it is. And another one is that many of these men in Guantanamo have been subject to torture, not just the torture of being in Guantanamo, but torture at the hands of CIA torturers. And God forbid they should somehow gain access to the press or gain access to other prisoners that would then help them get their stories out. And third, we're supposed to be a nation of laws. We're supposed to be a nation governed by a constitution. And none of these men have been given their constitutional rights. And so how do we justify that? Well, what we do is we just don't allow them access to a court. So we don't have to justify that to anybody. This is a stain on our country, a stain that's been on us since 2002. And there's nobody on Capitol Hill or anywhere else in government that's demanding that this be corrected.
Jim Cavanaugh, go ahead. I mean, 780 people were sent originally to Guantanamo. I think the total number of convictions that stood were 3.
Yes,
out of
because
the 780.
Most of those people were just innocents who were scooped up or were turned over to U.S. authorities as a result of feuds that they had in their local villages. And what I mean is, in Afghanistan, and we ran into this kind of thing all the time at the CIA, if I owe you money, let's say we live in the same village in Afghanistan and I owe you money and I don't want to pay you back, I would go to the Americans and say, you see that guy over there? He's Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And the Americans would give you a $150 reward, snatch you and take you to Guantanamo, and nobody would ever see you again.
Yeah, and 15 of those people were children.
That's right.
Children. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of these guys, they are now are cleared, I think. Am I not right, John?
Yes, they're actually cleared.
The military said we have no case against these guys.
You're absolutely correct.
But they still won't release them. And that's a large part, I think, for what you said, John, and you've been, of course, very eloquent about, and paid for it dearly, that, you know, they don't want the story getting out about what's actually going on there with the torture, et cetera. And what this all demonstrates, you know, the suppression of our constitutional rights and the complete abandonment of any concern for that on the part of politicians and the budget itself is we have a permanent war economy now that's being used. Spend whatever you need and to crush whatever dissent and to put whoever you want in jail, because we are now in a situation where there's no way of other way of describing it. We're permanent war situation, not just war economy, but war culture. And it's really very, very bad, you know, and the media is behind it. In the Vietnam War, there was at least, you know, reporting that was allowed you to see something that was going on and get a little critical edge of it. Now, the only reporting on that is coming from places like, you know, RT and right, and Sputnik, and you got to go to those places, and they're going to shut them down.
Yeah, well, we hope not. We're going to fight to keep them open, and we thank all the people who are standing with RT and with Sputnik. Greg Mello, we have less than 3 minutes left, about 2.5. I'm looking at lawfareblog.com. They're analyzing the NDAA, the new one. They say, by far the most dramatic changes that the proposed 2018 NDAA would introduce are in the area of cyber policy and operations. We know that the next realm of military advances, or perhaps where the next wars will be fought, will be both cyber wars and wars in outer space. What do you think about this in regard to both?
This is self-destructive. You know, we are in a glass house. We're all in a glass house as far as cybersecurity. And we tend to think that in the U.S., we can dominate these spheres like we think we've dominated others. And I just, it's kind of sickening to behold. This can't end well. I'm not an expert in that, but it's clear it won't end well.
Yeah. Jeremy Kuzmarov, when you look around, the United States is planning contingencies for, as mad as it might seem, World War III, wars against Russia, wars against China. The last time the United States mainland was invaded was the War of 1812, so that was 205 years ago. What's driving all of this from your point of view? 1 minute left.
Well, yeah, I think we have to look at the class interests and what we've been discussing, those who profit off this system, as well as the multinational corporations who have interests around the world and see, you know, a threat from a resurgent Russia or you know, China that's becoming more powerful, forming, you know, alternative power blocks and trying to expand its own economic influence around the world. So I think we have to look at the class divisions and special interests that have taken over our government in this kind of oligarchy that has evolved.
John, he's right. War is good business, yeah, and thus business incentivizes war.
That's right, and it's no wonder that the highest concentration of millionaires now is in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. It's because all of these war profiteers did exactly that. They got rich.
Yeah, fleecing the national treasury and the national budget.
And that's why they need an enemy, because with Crimea, you're saying, I mean, the Crimeans voted to join Russia, so there's no real reason at all. It's just drumming up hysteria, because you need an enemy to justify what you're doing. It's not a real enemy.
We're going to leave it right there. We're completely out of time. We've been joined by Jim Kavanaugh, Jeremy Kuzmarov, and Greg Mello. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Society is facing a watershed moment as more and more women offer revelations of sexual harassment and sexual assault committed against them. Powerful men, meanwhile, have begun paying for their abuse, harassment, and criminal acts with their careers. A new documentary film has just been released featuring 16 women, each of whom says they were the victims of abuse and harassment by Donald Trump. Trump asserts that the Democratic Party opponents who have tried to torpedo his administration by asserting that the Russian government acted in collusion with Trump in the 2016 election campaign have failed to prove their case, and after 18 months of investigation, and that they are now turning to the long-standing allegations against Trump for sexual abuse as the next stage in an effort to bring down his administration. We are joined from Philadelphia by Dr. Nazia Kazi. She is a professor of anthropology at Stockton University. And we're joined from Washington by Sue Udry. She is a peace and social justice activist, and she is the executive director of Defending Rights and Dissent. Welcome, Nazia and Sue. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Nazia, I mean, the film that's just come out, 16 Women and Trump, some of the women held a press conference in New York yesterday. They each told their own stories, but the stories were very similar about how Donald Trump, the wealthy Donald Trump, the Donald Trump who owned the Miss USA or Miss Universe pageant, routinely engaged in abusive behavior and harassment. At the same time, the Democrats are mounting a campaign as these revelations come to the surface again, that Trump should step down. So talk about the moment, the Me Too moment, the allegations, Trump, and the politics here. And we're going to try to spend some time trying to dig through this intertangled combination of different features of this ongoing episode in American politics and in the larger society. Go ahead.
Sure. So I think, you know, in this political moment that we find ourselves in, it's really important to be mindful of how the highest seats of power in American politics have always done a tremendous job of co-opting things that are the concerns of perhaps the most marginalized among us, whether we're talking about civil rights, anti-racist activism, in this case, gender justice and feminism. What we see is a wholesale co-opting of this movement, both by people on the right and by people in the Democratic Liberal Party establishment. So, of course, we shouldn't be surprised about these allegations of sexual assault that have been brought against Donald Trump. He himself, we all heard him talking about it in a recording, which he initially apologized for, but more recently claimed was a fabricated recording. So we see this wholesale sort of national conversation on the subject. I just read that Merriam-Webster's word of the year is feminism. And when they were asked about selecting this word, they said it was the curiosity about feminism as a word was spiked after the release of Wonder Woman. Okay, so this is an interesting moment for us to think about how we see feminism being co-opted right before our eyes. Obviously, the curiosity about feminism being sparked by the release of Wonder Woman, featuring Gal Gadot, a former IDF soldier who has spoken very vocally about in favor of settler colonialism in Palestine, should be a stark reminder of the ways in which we find radical movements being co-opted and people easily being distracted from the issues at hand. And we can really trace this as a key feature through the Trump presidency. I mean, compare what happened the day after inauguration earlier this year in D.C., which was the Women's March, you know, with the pink hats. We're all familiar with the imagery. Compare that to what the defendants of the J-20 arrests, folks who actually protested on Inauguration Day, are facing. And you see that we have a stark disparity of the folks who gathered kind of ready to collaborate and work with police and on the day after inauguration and the deep repression that we see being faced by the J-20 defendants. So while I think it's really important that we turn our attention to the conversation that's being had now, we have to do so with great nuance and great awareness of the ways in which the political elite will attempt to co-opt and politicize this in really troubling ways.
I think that's right, Brian. You know, another thing that's interesting to me is it's fun. Well, I shouldn't say fun, but maybe it's a little bit fun to watch all the name calling going back and forth. Donald Trump, I think, on a daily basis is entertaining in that he makes a fool of himself. He picks these fights. He looks silly. He looks childish. And it's kind of fun to watch the show. With that said, I think that one of the things that many Americans are missing, and certainly the mainstream media is missing, is that we've got 5 senators now and 53 House members that are calling on the president of the United States to resign, right? To resign in shame. I'm hard pressed to remember a time since Richard Nixon resigned in 1974 when so many elected members of Congress are calling on a sitting president to resign. You can disagree with policies, right? You can say the Iraq War was illegal and George W. Bush should step down. Maybe two or three or four members of Congress did that. But this is different. This is turning into something.
Yeah. So, Udry, I want you to comment, give your own views on this whole issue and the intertangling of different phenomena that we see going on, because there is the grassroots organic Me Too movement. And this movement is resonating with women and people who have suffered abuse and harassment in silence and not having been believed. I mean, it's an important moment. And at the same time, as Dr. Nazia Kazi pointed out, political elites have their own agenda here. So go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dr. Kazi, I'm now your newest fan. Thanks a lot for your analysis. I really agree with what you're saying. And there was just a whole lot to unpack from what both Dr. Kazi and what John was saying. And I guess since it was more recent, let me address something that you were saying, John, about the number of representatives and senators, Democratic senators and representatives who have called on Trump to resign. And I agree that's unprecedented in a long time, but it's also easy, right? It's so easy for them to do that. Let's see them challenge him on his policies. They're about, you know, the Democrats are about to vote to renew Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, which gives the president, gives the CIA and the FBI just incredible powers of surveillance. And they're rolling over. They're giving that to him. You know, they're finally, in a cause close to my heart, they're finally accusing the FBI of being political when, you know, their whole history they've been political, but mostly their politics have been to undercut movements of dissent and communities of color. And now when they're going after people in power, all of a sudden the Republicans are concerned about, you know, FBI politicization. So it's really interesting the way the ground is shifting all around us on different different policies and different, you know, people who used to be the bad guys are now the good guys, depending if you're, you know, if they're helping the Republicans this minute or the Democrats the next minute. And it's all childish and infantile on the president's behalf and on our so many of our elected officials in Congress. So that's my first point. And then as far as Me Too, yes, the people in power are always trying to usurp grassroots movements and use them, twist them to their own political ends, right? But I think the interesting thing about particularly the Me Too movement right now is that we do need to acknowledge that many women in Congress and many women who have achieved positions of power actually have also been victims of sexual assault and sexual abuse. So we can't take that away from them. We can call them out when they try to twist the movement to their own political purposes. But I would say a lot of them also have experienced what so many of us have experienced, and we can't tell them that they're not allowed to say Me Too also.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Kazia.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things, questions about the allegations that have been brought against Trump were hurled at him by journalists while he was signing the defense spending bill, the National Defense Authorization Act. So now we have a military budget of some $700 billion. I mean, the largest military the world has ever seen, the biggest war budget ever. And we all know that the U.S. military is perhaps one of the largest purveyors of sexual violence, both within its ranks and around the world. And so when we're thinking about, you know, sexual assault, we have to be thinking in these larger systemic ways. I mean, this bill, this NDAA, received overwhelmingly bipartisan support. And I think it's important for us to be mindful and sort of zooming out and thinking about it on this level.
Indeed. That's the voice of Dr. Nazia Kazi. She is a professor of anthropology at Stockton University. We're talking to her from Philadelphia, and from Washington, D.C., by Sue Udry. She is a peace and social justice activist and the executive director of Defending Rights and Dissent. I'm really glad that Dr. Kazi pointed this out, because we were just talking, John, in our earlier segment about the NDAA. Congress, and it's bipartisan, it's the Democrats and Republicans, including the Democrats who are now calling for Trump to resign. They actually increased the amount given to the Pentagon and to the intelligence agencies beyond that which Trump asked for. So now the United States military budget will be officially over $700 billion. And really, when you look at the real numbers, closer to $1 trillion. And that money is used to bomb Yemen, to bomb Afghanistan, to bomb Iraq, to invade earlier Iraq. A million people, perhaps as many as a million, died, according to the Lancet Medical Journal, who would not have otherwise died if it had not been for the war. The bombing of Libya in 2011. I mean, all of these criminal acts, the Democrats are basically mute about these.
Yeah, the Democrats are mute on most of these issues. We know, for example, that the National Defense Authorization Act was passed by voice vote, which we've already discussed on another segment. Voice vote, that just means that whoever happens to be in the chair, either the president pro tem of the Senate or the Speaker of the House of Representatives, calls it to question and says, all those in favor say aye, all those opposed nay, the ayes have it. And then that's it. It's passed. Now, if you are opposed to it, it is incumbent upon you to get up and say, I would have voted no had there been a recorded vote. Or if you really have some guts, you can demand an actual vote by objecting to the voice vote. Nobody did that. Nobody objected to the voice vote. Yeah. Nobody had the guts to stand up and say, let's put our names on this thing and see who's for it and who's against it. Look at the move of the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I think most Americans don't realize that the vote to endorse that in the Senate was 90-0 with 10 members not being present. 90-0. You know, so we can't just point the finger at Donald Trump. It's all of our elected officials on Capitol Hill. They're all a part of the problem.
Sue, I'm glad you mentioned that as we're dissecting how the politics and the politics of co-optation happen, we don't also want to minimize what this moment might mean. In other words, we could be at a pivotal moment where, as we have had at different times in history, both with the Black Civil Rights Movement, the Black Liberation Movement, the earlier women's movement in the late 1960s, early 70s, a pivotal moment where women who have traditionally been not believed or facing such odds when they were to report harassment or abuse or criminal acts, really, by their bosses or by men who are powerful and around them. This is a pivotal moment. We can't minimize the potential of the moment, but we can also understand that there could be a developed cynicism about the moment if it simply becomes or looks like the plaything of political elites.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's you know, it is interesting, though, to look at, you know, last year's Democratic standard bearer, Hillary Clinton, that all of these Democratic women supported wholeheartedly, despite of the way that she eagerly trashed the reputation of any woman who accused her husband of sexual harassment. So I haven't even begun, and maybe Dr. Kazi has this. I don't have a political analysis of the way this is all playing out, and I would rather have the Democratic senators embracing the Me Too movement and saying yes, let's listen to women. It's not even a fine line. There's a definite line there that we don't want to let them cross to usurp a grassroots movement of people who are fighting for rights and equity.
Dr. Kazi, let's step back to again. I'm glad you mentioned January 20th. I was there on the parade route on January 20th, part of a large protest organized by the Answer Coalition. There was probably 15,000 people there. A lot of people couldn't get through the barricades that were set up by the law enforcement. And some of those people marched. And then the government, because a few people broke windows, and we don't know if those few people were, you know, undercover police agents, for instance, because we know there's been a lot of undercover police work done in Washington. But people, just by virtue of their proximity to any kind of window breaking or vandalism, have been swept up. They're now facing literally decades in jail, and the prosecution's really going after them. This is not like just charge stacking. They're trying to get people, and their people are on trial right now. And then there was that burst of activism that was at the airports, where people went to the airports to say no to Donald Trump's travel ban, the Muslim ban. There was this kind of organic uprising of American people, maybe as many as one out of every three Americans engaged in a protest. But it seems to me that the Democratic Party was able to take over a big part of the noise or the voice of that so-called resistance and channel it into what I consider to be a largely reactionary and unproved campaign against Russia, with the purpose of trying to bring Trump down, but on an allegation that couldn't be proved. I mean, it's 18 months later. There's still no there. There's no real evidence. Do you think the Democrats are now moving on as Trump? That's what Trump is saying. They couldn't prove the Russiagate allegation, so now they're moving on to something else. I mean, do you think that's the case?
I mean, it's very uncomfortable to have to sometimes agree with Donald Trump. I find myself doing that sometimes when he accuses the mainstream corporate media of being fake news, which, frankly, is quite often the case. So I will not say that I agree with Trump, but I will say that the ways in which these conversations are taking up space in this political moment are really remarkable. I mean, I think and I was also at inauguration. I left before the Women's March very deliberately, but I was there for J20, and I am horrified to read about what has been happening to the fellow protesters who were there with me, being caught up in this horrific act of suppression. That should be a major headline story right now. Muslim ban 3.0 just passed. It was approved. I mean, the airport protests you were speaking of were in response to the first version of the proto version of that. And so, of course, this movement is deserving of all of our attention, but the ways in which it is taking shape along these partisan lines, it might be a supreme diversion from the issue at hand. I mean, I recently saw a piece, I believe it was in Al Jazeera, where it was talking about how Me Too is an issue for American farm workers, for women who work on American farms in agribusiness, and rampant sexual violence and sexual assault for some of our lowest paid workers. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with the case of Cyntoia Brown, who is likely to spend her whole life in prison for killing, out of self-defense, somebody while she was trafficked into the sex trade. So, you know, there's a much larger conversation to be had that I fear is not being had right now.
Go ahead, Sue.
Well, right. To riff off of that, the plight of low-paid workers and farm workers who, have no recourse against abusers who are their employers or their supervisors, and then kind of link that to the attack on unions and the Democrats' pretty anemic response to protecting our unions. What can help workers is a strong union, and yet that's nowhere in the conversation. When Trump talks about bringing back good manufacturing jobs, you know, he's not talking about manufacturing jobs. He's talking about union jobs, but he's not really. And so I think that's absolutely right. The conversation is really getting hijacked by the Democrats to prevent actual challenge to the corporate and, you know, if you will, capitalist structure that we're trapped in.
And Sue, because you're here in Washington where the J20 trials are taking place, just very briefly, just talk about the status of those trials. People are facing decades in prison.
They sure are. And so there's about 200 people who are still facing charges. But there's so many curious things going on just procedurally with these trials. Right now, they've put people into batches of less than 10 people at a time are being tried together. So right now we're in the midst of the first trial of the first batch of people, which is, I believe it's 6 people. They've been on trial for about a month now, with the prosecution not even pretending to say that they think these 6 people actually broke any windows. That's not even on the table.
It's guilt by association.
Yeah, they're
guilt
just
by association.
Saying, Yep, they're saying they were there, they shouldn't have been there, they made a choice to be there, and therefore they are guilty. But meanwhile, all sorts of things are coming out. The one of the undercover cops has been on the witness stand talking about how he had infiltrated the organizers beforehand, and they were talking about organizing a peaceful but confrontational protest. We heard recordings that the cop in charge that day had decided that he was going to mass arrest everybody even before they had started marching. And when some windows got broken, police were there, but they didn't move in to arrest.
They didn't stop those people. They let those windows get broken. They wanted the windows, I believe, to be broken.
Sure, they did.
And then you have the Democrats. And here's the thing, and I'm grateful to both guests, because here's the thing. The Democrats, who are trying to harness all of the justifiable, righteous anger against Donald Trump, and we have a lot of reasons. I mean, mass deportations, the breakup of immigrant families, the expanded military budget, the telling the police departments around the country, hey, those consent decrees are coming apart. Go at them, guys. We're going to bring back the good old days. I mean, there's so many reasons to be against Donald Trump. But it's all sort of put into these very narrow categories. And meanwhile, the Democrats don't say a thing in defense of these people who are facing decades in prison because they wanted to come out and speak against Trump on Inauguration Day. I mean, it's really incredible. Dr. Kazi, we have just a couple minutes left. I mean, where is it all heading? Where do you think it's going?
You know, I hate to end on a pessimistic note, but, you know, I see that, you know, Time Magazine, right, which I believe was just acquired by some really atrocious media figure. But anyway, Time Magazine has named the Silence Breakers, right, as the people of the year, and has easily edited off the cover the fact that the Me Too movement itself was started by a Black woman who has devoted so much of her grassroots activist energy on providing sexual assault services to the most underserved communities in the U.S., right? And it feels like, unfortunately, history repeating itself. I mean, we've seen that happen with, you know, the ways in which Stonewall, which was launched by trans Black American voices against the police, has been turned into a very white centric movement we now call Pride. And this is one of the things I spend a lot of my energy in the classroom getting our young college students to see, which is the ways in which really beautiful, radical energy is so easily co-opted by the seats of power. And I worry that we see that happening again.
Yeah, back in the day, Richard Nixon said, "All power to the people." We were all shocked, those of us who were in the streets in 1969. But the ability to co-opt, the ability to transform, or the attempt to transform, I think, is an ever present phenomenon. Because of course, when there's genuine mass grassroots resistance, you can't simply contain it militarily. You have to also at least win over a part of that movement into a sort of a harmless channel that the powers that be can, you know, sort of keep it under tow. In other words, it's a way of harnessing the same energy, but turning it into something harmless. By the way, Time Magazine was purchased by Meredith Corporation, with a big part of their investment from the Koch brothers, the right-wing Koch brothers. And we see the processes of co-optation going on. But what I'm also interested in is whether or not, as a consequence of these different mass movements that are going on that are independent and come from the grassroots, whether it was the Black Lives Matter movement, the Occupy movement, even the immigrant rights movement that started in 2006 with that general strike, whether there will be an ability to retain independence. In other words, and that's why I think this conversation is so important. How do you fight against Trump and his egregious reactionary behavior without becoming the tail to the kite of the Democratic Party, which has its own narrow and, I would say, almost equally reactionary agenda? Go ahead, Sue.
Well, I think people do it by being educated, and I think a lot of people recognize this is what's going on, right? And they're fighting against it. And while they can attempt to co-opt movements, they can't stop them from starting and growing, right? Movements keep happening. People keep getting out in the streets. People keep organizing and keep fighting. You know, it's a force of nature, and it's going to keep happening. And I'm trying to not be depressing.
Yeah, well, we can't be depressed, because if you're depressed, I mean, depression or cynicism lead to passivity.
Yes.
And if the people are passive, if these social movements become cynical or passive, which is different from skeptical, but cynical or passive, then those who are in charge, the powers that be, those who seek to manipulate these movements actually always would succeed. Dr. Kazi, do you think the Russiagate is going to go anywhere, or is the political sort of elite opposition to Trump that fancies itself as the resistance, are they going to shift now mainly in the direction, having failed, I would say, with providing any indictments or clear evidence of Russiagate, are they going to shift? Is this going to be the new arena for anti-Trump resistance from the Democratic Party?
You know, I'm not sure. I know that for sure one of the a major effects of Russiagate has been the remarkable manipulation of our fear and our expectations. I mean, every few weeks you think there's going to be some major break. I mean, everything has remained the same, right? And so there's that. But also, I think we need to think a little past that in terms of, let's say, Russiagate, quote unquote, is successful, is what the Democrats want. The dangers of a President Pence are not to be underestimated. Someone who has, you know, legislative experience, someone who won't go wild on Twitter and has a really sinister political program, and also runs the risk of silencing so much of the quote unquote resistance that has been railing against Trump. And that's really important. Also, I wonder what would happen to all of those diehard Trump fans who, you know, if Russiagate were successful, the heavily armed fan base of his is not going to take it lightly. So I think we should be careful about winning some kind of Pyrrhic victory in this case.
Oh, that's an excellent point.
Yeah,
if people in Trump's base think that his administration was torpedoed by a false fake news campaign about Russiagate, or if they actually think about sexual allegations or allegations of harassment and criminal conduct also being in the same vein, instead of this being a pivotal moment in sort of an emancipatory moment for women, it could be turned, in fact, just into its opposite. I don't think that will happen, but I could see it happening. So, Idri, you get the final word, last 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think that is something to be concerned about, and I think that the way that I absolutely agree. The Russiagate investigation and campaign is a real concern, also because of the way that it is demonizing actual movements of dissent and protest, and saying that they are kind of handmaidens to the Russian government, which is just, you know, harkens right back to McCarthy period. And so, thank you, Democrats, for bringing us that one.
Yeah, indeed. And it's fundamentally racist, just as Dr. King was always being accused that communist outside agitators were the reason the civil rights movement was taking off. The outlandish idea that somehow the Black Lives Matter movement or the movement against police violence was the result of some foreign power. I mean, it's insulting, it's racist, and of course, it's wrong. We're out of time, John. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Dr. Nazia Kazi. She is a professor of anthropology at Stockton University. And we've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Sue Udry. She is a peace and social justice activist, and she is the executive director of Defending Rights and Dissent. After a short break, we'll be right back with the big stories of today.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.